This webcast is a service of SDPB. Good, useful, and full of wonder. SDPB.
On the code of the Honorable Chief Justice Stephen R. Jensen presiding is now in session.
You may be seated. Thank you. Good morning. We're once again pleased to be here at Augustana University for our March term of court. And we appreciate Augustana being great hosts for us this week. We have three cases set for argument this morning, and after we finish our third case, for those of you that are here in the audience, if you want to stick around, and we'd welcome to do that, we're going to have an opportunity for question and answer time afterward. We can't talk about the cases that have been argued this morning, but just general questions about what we do as a court and how our court system works. We'd love to have an opportunity to dialogue with you when we get done here this morning with our three cases. So with that, the first case for argument this morning is appeal number 31100, 31144, Viva Capital versus Jerry Garrett et al. Nicholas Novy will be arguing on behalf of Jerry Garrett. And Kawaiya LeQuain will be arguing on behalf of Viva Capital Trust Corporation. With that, each side will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and then Mr. Novy will have a 5-minute rebuttal. You can proceed, Mr. Novy.
Thank you, Your Honor. Excuse me.
It's a little short.
It is. It is. I'm doing my best. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Nicholas Novy, and I represent the estate of Frank Garrett Jr. on this appeal. For over 100 years, South Dakota has prohibited human life wagering. They've done so through their constitution, through statutory prohibitions, and through 100 years of case law that suggests South Dakota courts and trial courts should be piercing the disguise of these transactions and not just looking to the mere form of the transaction. Now, there's no dispute here that if United National Funding, the third-party investor in this case, were to go to Florida and pick out a senior citizen by the name of Frank Garrett and procure a policy on his life and name United National Funding, the bank, as the beneficiary, of course that would violate the insurable interest statute, and of course that would be an unlawful wager. So the question before this court here today is quite simple. Can United achieve that result indirectly through the creation of a South Dakota trust to conceal what's really going on? These transactions, these indirect transactions, are known as STOLI. STOLI is where strangers originate the policy, fund the policy, all for the benefit of other investors because they're trying to create an investment vehicle. And the insureds in these cases are instrumentalities. They're straw men. Now, the validity of whether STOLI is legal across the country is usually turned on one simple fact. Are courts willing to pierce the disguise of the transaction and figure out what really happened, or are they just going to look at the forms, look at the forms of the documents that the transaction are printed on?
And I want to stop you just for a moment, just an ad hoc question on I think you referenced in your brief that, you know, maybe the trust was formed here in South Dakota because there's less regulation or something like that. Is there any evidence or do we have anybody telling us why this trust ended up being set up in South Dakota?
So thank you, Justice Jensen. The answer to your question is a little bit twofold. First, there is evidence in the record that these investors targeted South Dakota because they believe South Dakota would be beneficial for them.
And where would we find that in the record?
I can certainly get that site and have it for you on the reply, Your Honor. but to answer your question as to why, it's a little bit more muddied as to why, but at the very highest level, they thought they could get away with their STOLI scheme and their human life wagering by using a South Dakota trust to conceal what's really going on.
Because you have a limited amount of time, counsel, I just want to, so there are a couple issues here, and there's been this, the court, part of its basis was that the challenge to the trust itself could not be brought because of our statute of repose, And I know there are different arguments by both sides on that. But in the event that is true, does at least one of your counterclaims still remain, even if we did not, couldn't refer to your claims as to why the trust itself?
Thank you, Justice Devaney. I appreciate the question. So the statute of repose here doesn't apply for three simple reasons. The first is it wasn't even enacted until after this trust had long terminated. So the statute wasn't enacted until 2010. This is a 2006 trust that held no assets whatsoever, only this life insurance policy, which was then relinquished in 2009.
Does it matter the fact that the insurer died, and that's the trigger point of the 1 year after the statute was in effect?
Sure. I think if I understand your question correctly, you're asking because the insured did not pass away until recently, and therefore the statute was enacted. I mean, our reading of the statute is quite simple. It's meant to, the purpose of the statute is meant for a trust contest. It is meant to efficient distribution of trust property. Here, that is not what this case is about at all. We're not seeking any trust property.
I'm going to stop you there. The actual statute refers to a judicial proceeding to contest whether an irrevocable trust was validly created. So that seems broader than what you're claiming.
The understood that the statute language is rather broad. I was simply making the point that this court has long held that the purpose of the statute is about trust, efficient trust distribution. And to answer your question really directly, Justice Devaney, our case is not predicated on the invalidation of this trust at all.
That was my primary question.
The crux of this case is about the insurable interest statute and applying the insurable interest statute to the facts of this case. And going back to how the trial court, going back to one additional point, is that states that have constitutional prohibitions and strong common law that suggests that courts should be piercing the disguise of these transactions have almost all uniformly held that STOLE is illegal and that it's a fraud on the court and that it's a human life wagering scheme. Now, trial court Judge Hoffman erred here in multiple respects. Didn't analyze the statute correctly, didn't give meaning to the words of the statute. He also didn't really conduct a thorough factual analysis of what really went on here. He didn't pierce the disguise of the transaction, as this court has long held trial courts.
Can I hold you up there for just a minute? So are we talking about two things there, and do you need them both to win? Here's what I mean. So is it possible that Judge Hoffman read the statutes exactly right? I know you don't say that, but is it possible that they do, in fact, operate as he said that they operated? But nevertheless, you see a public policy issue that's in tension with the entire STOLE concept. This piercing that you keep referring to, you know, we have cases, in fact, recently, no one cited it, but there's an Equitable Mortgage case called Sturgenbecker where we held, look, there's a lease, there's a buyback, there's a loan, there's all this stuff, and, you know, it's not called a mortgage, but we can look at it, we can say, you know what, that's a mortgage. And you have to give someone redemption rights. And you can't outflank their redemption rights. When you say pierce, is that what you're talking about? And if it is, what difference does it make if there's technical compliance if what you're really asking us to do is look at the substance of this and say, what is it?
That's exactly right, Justice Salters. We're absolutely asking this court to look at the substance of what went on here, and that's how we think the trial court erred. However, we do think a relatively plain reading of the statute, which does require statutes to be read in harmony, and I'm happy to talk more about that, and to interpret the statute in a way that is consistent with the Constitution and consistent with statutory, with general statutes of prohibiting wager. We think
I thought you kind of conceded this, but maybe I'm wrong. I thought you, in your initial statement, you kind of conceded, if you look at the plain language of the statute, you know, there's an argument here that there was an insurable interest for Jerry. And so I thought you kind of conceded that, and we have to do more than just look at the plain language, as I understand your argument.
That's right. I mean, look, to keep this really simple, Your Honors, is the substance, the real question before this court is whether it's going to apply form over substance or substance over form. And that's really the delineating factor in all of these STOLE cases, is whether courts are willing to pierce the disguise of the transaction to ascertain the true activities involved. That's from this court's decision in Waite v. Frank all the way up in 2009, this court's decision in Nev v. Davis. The same principles apply here.
Yeah, I understand that argument, because I mean, I think you could make, you don't have to concede it, I won't put you on the spot that way, but there's a pretty good argument under 5810.4.6 concerning the trust and the insurable interest of the trustee. It's not a throwaway argument, what Judge Hoffman said, what he decided, and how he read it.
So if I may address that?
By all means, yeah.
So going right to the statutory language, right, 5810.4. 5810.3 talks about procure cause to be procured unless the policies are payable. I think, Justice Salter, your question is directly related to, you know, can a policy have insurable interest if it has a trust with a beneficiary that's named a family member? And the answer is no, for several reasons. you know, the first is that this idea that the family may have received some money at some point is exactly the promise that induced Frank to participate in this scheme from the very beginning. It's exactly that promise of possible future financial compensation conditioned on what condition? On his death. That is part and parcel of the wager. Back in the old STOLE days, STOLE promoters would would try to induce senior citizens to engage in these transactions by giving them cars or watches, just to sign on the dotted line. But here, this is even more so a wager, because United was interested in his early death, but only if Frank survived the first 2 years, so that it could obtain the policy on his life.
Go ahead.
Well, you know, and it appears there was, facts produced, and I think there was a record question by the chief, and I think it was someone that worked for United that kind of explained how the whole thing went down, but there's quite a vetting process in who they're gonna target here, a certain age, certain medical history, what is the likelihood they're gonna live past 2 years, but maybe not so much longer after that, and a lot of features that went into this. It also appeared to me from reading all the cases that these programs have kind of evolved as the court ruling started coming down. So this current one, and it seems like the latest iteration, is to have very specific three different options of what happens when your loan comes due. And the likelihood that you're going to be able to assume the premiums is probably slim to none. But the fact that there are these other options in these programs, does that at all come into play? And if so, how, as to whether or not this is truly one of these schemes that was designed to result in the insured person never having, or an uninsurable interest entity ending up with it.
Understood. Thank you, Justice Devaney. And I would say this simply, the fact that the insured had these technical, hyper-technical options that they were never real options the insurance itself was never intended for any insurance purpose. It was intended as a wager. And the fact that it's possible, hyper-technically, that Frank could have somehow funded this trust. Remember, Frank was not even the borrower of the loan, first and foremost. The trust was the borrower of the loan. The trust had absolutely no assets. But putting that aside, you know, all these STOLE programs, as you allude to, Justice Devaney, work like this. They have a trust that conceals the nature of the transaction, right? And then I'm sorry. Can you just re-ask just the last part of that question, please?
Well, it kind of goes to a fact issue. So let's say if we decide, yes, our common law, and for many of the reasons argued, would allow us to look to the substance of the transaction rather than the form. Is there a dispute of fact here as to whether the particular way this one was set up, whether it meets the STOLE playbook, and were there features about what actually happened here that would still weigh against us determining that this one was in violation, and part of it is the options and what Frank
Understood. Thank you so much for that clarification, Justice Devaney. Look, there's absolutely no dispute of fact here that this was a wagering contract for investors, procured by investors, funded by investors. United, just a few of the facts at a really high level. United paid all of the premiums. Garrett paid none of the premiums, received nothing in return. United controlled every aspect of this transaction. It controlled who the carrier was, what the loan amount was, how much premiums to pay, et cetera. They controlled every single one of the transaction documents that could not be altered or amended. These were boilerplate forms that Frank simply signed. And so Frank really contributed nothing except for his name, his insurability.
And more to the back end.
Mm-hmm.
What happens after?
Yeah, in the back end, the way all of these transactions worked, where they were designed for the purpose of creating an investment vehicle, and therefore the only real two options, Justice Devaney, were that either the investor that funded the premiums here, United, would receive what they always desired, the policy, or they would get, there is a risk they would get outbid by another investor coming in and outbidding United and therefore receiving the policy. But in either event, the policy was going to investors. And there's deposition testimony in here from the individual who helped Frank through this process at the back end. And he said there was no real discussion of him ever wanting or even contemplating, right, putting up the money for this policy. So I think that answers your question, Justice Devaney.
So we want to go back to, usually when you have a lawsuit and there's somebody engaged in wrongful conduct, if that happened in this case, there's damages, and I know your relief isn't exactly damages, and doesn't appear Jerry actually had any skin in the game or the estate has been harmed in any way that I can see. You can tell me if that's other than that. Seems like Mass Mutual, if there was anybody harmed in this case, it seems like they're the party that should be bringing this. I know some of these STOLE cases are the insurance company brings the claim and says, hey, we were defrauded and all that sort of thing. I mean, the estate's not really out anything, and I think of wrongful conduct, I think of damages, and we don't really seem to have that in this case, and it almost seems like the estate's now coming in saying, somebody else made some money on it, maybe I can make some money on it. And that's one of the concerns I have in terms of just how this lawsuit is set up.
So thank you for the question, Justice Jensen. Respectfully, the estate is harmed in this case, and respectfully, Warnock and from dating back from 1800s and was codified by this court, by this legislature in 1966, codified the right for the estate to bring this action. And the legislature did that for a few reasons, right? One is to discourage these types of transactions from the very beginning. We don't want investors, right? This policy is made for investors, so we don't want them buying this up on the secondary market, creating a larger demand and therefore increasing the need to create the supply, right? And so the point of the recovery claim under 5810.5, which is statutory entitled for the estate, is that the estate is to disincentivize these types of policies altogether.
This may be a fine point, but I had a similar question on the 5810.5 statute. It doesn't articulate a theory for recovery unless you can infer, well, the theory is the statutory noncompliance or with the three statute, maybe that's what you get. But it says, textually, it says, may maintain an action. It seems to create an action. But it seems as though it had me thinking, hey, does there have to be an underlying theory of recovery? There's fraud, there's something. Or maybe it is just the statute or noncompliance with the insurable interest statute and the -3 statute. I don't know. But I thought that was weird. We have some other statutes that do that, where they just create cause of action. They don't finish it, they just create it. And someone has to come up with a legal theory, damages, all that stuff in order to complete the arc.
Understood.
You got a red light, but I'll let you finish the question, then you can wrap up.
I'm sorry. If I may just address that briefly. I'm sorry. Caught me a little off guard. The question.
Yeah,
and
just
I'll,
that.
I'll
text.
Do my best to summarize
maybe,
it quickly.
Maybe it's just one of those things we don't really know, and I'm putting a little bit on the spot. But just that text is a little bit interesting. In the five statute, it may maintain an action. What is the action? Does that contemplate the sorts of things that we would usually contemplate in civil actions generally? Because this may not end it. The five statute may not just say, there's compliance, you're here, you just get it. Don't you have to prove damages? Don't you have to prove some other things we would expect in a civil action? Just your thoughts. There's no right or wrong. I'm just kind of thinking about it.
Understood. Thank you for that clarification. So 58.10.5 does create a cause of action, and the theory is lack of insurable interest. This is, South Dakota is one of 27 states that have these types of statutes. Every state interprets it exactly the same way, right? The state can bring a claim, and the claim accrues at the time of the state's set up, and the claim can be brought by the estate under 58.10.5. The theory is lack of insurable interest. If there is no insurable interest on the policy, then the estate is entitled to the death benefit.
Yeah, and I suppose the Froehlich case would, to some extent, support that. I get that. Okay, thank you.
That's exactly right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. McClain, you may proceed with your argument.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Kai LeKwong, and I represent the appellee, Viva Capital III. I'd first just like to say a lot of things were said that I don't think accurately reflect the record, and I'd like to address that in a little bit. But I want to start out by the hypothetical that Mr. Novy posed at the beginning of whether UNF is actually doing indirectly what it couldn't do directly. And it's not. UNF is nothing more than a lender here. UNF did not control the process, did not procure the policy, didn't even cause Mr. Garrett to procure the policy. The evidence here, and the record is clear on this, that Mr. Garrett was introduced to the idea of life insurance at the outset by attending a seminar by a life insurance agent who had nothing to do with UNF. He knew of UNF, he knew that UNF provided funding, but the spark and the plug, the spark of this whole transaction was just Mr. Garrett on his own deciding to attend a seminar. And at that seminar, he learned about life insurance, and I suspect, although the record's not entirely clear about this, he learned about premium financing. And premium financing, funding premiums on a life insurance policy, has existed for a long time. And in fact, one justice asked the question of, is there any record as to why UNF wanted to create this in South Dakota? And it is. There's the deposition of, I think his name is Richard Kearns. Mr. Kearns was the UNF representative at a deposition, and he explained that they did go into or wanted to set this up in South Dakota mainly because of the lending laws. Because it was easier to create and get a license as a premium finance lender, and because of the usury laws in South Dakota allowed certain rates to be higher and not violate the usury laws. And the need to charge a higher rate is tied to sort of the risk that the lender is taking here. And in fact, the risk that UNF took in lending on a life insurance policy was that it's not a particularly liquid asset. And the reason that you got these new premium finance programs in the early 2000s was because there was a legitimate secondary market for life insurance. And many of the cases that the estate cites recognize this legitimate secondary market that spawned out of the AIDS epidemic in which, a lot of people were able to sell their life insurance policies.
That's life settlement. That's a totally different matter, though, than what we're talking about here. Isn't that correct?
It's very related, and I'll explain why. Okay, that life settlement market, that viatical market, created a new and vibrant and real secondary market where people could sell their life insurance even if they weren't terminally ill. And it's because of that market that life insurance became a bit more liquid and you could lend on it. And so some people in the early 2000s began to become premium finance lenders, because the asset became, if you had to foreclose on the loan, you could actually sell it into this secondary or tertiary market and not have to keep an asset that, unlike a home, if I have to foreclose on a home, I can just let it sit on a lot and I don't have to do anything. If I foreclose on a life insurance policy, I gotta keep funding premiums on it. And lenders did not want to do that. And that was, in fact, the testimony of Mr. Current. He said, we did not want to own policies. We were lending to lend and essentially priced the cost of our loan, which, by the way, is unlike other loans described in these cases that we talk about. He said, we needed to price this loan in a way that we were going to get at least 15, 17, 18% return, because that was the quote-unquote hurdle rate that they needed to achieve in their asset-backed loans.
Does part of this go, though, in terms of who they approve, you know, in the selection of the insured that actually enters into one of these? Because I understand everything you're saying about the need for the high interest rate and all of that, but part of that also goes to the very unlikelihood that this particular person, given their assets, their income, what have you, they is going to be able to assume those premiums.
So again,
after the loan, and you know, because that's one of the things you see in the courts have looked at is they seem to be designed and targeted towards certain people that are very unlikely to ever be able to do that. So the underlying goal from the get-go,
yes,
is that it's going to be sold in the market to someone without an insurable interest.
Your Honor, I actually think that is a distinguishing fact among many between this case and the other cases the estate cited. Frank Garrett, undisputably, was worth at least $20 million. He owned approximately $16 to $20 million in real estate in the heart of Silicon Valley, which I can only imagine is worth a lot more when you're planning your estate, i.e., what will you be worth when you die? So there's no question, there's no evidence that UNF targeted people who couldn't pay. The evidence is that they actually had a loan application. In the connection with the loan committal letter, there was an application submitted. It asked a whole number of questions about the insured's credit. But on top of that, the requirements with respect to the insured's are really about whether this policy is such that if we foreclose on it, it is adequately secures the amount of premium that we're paying. If you lend to a borrower who's 40 years old, you will not have a policy that is worth or something that could be sold in the secondary market if you had to foreclose on it. And there's a reason for that. It's because a 40-year-old is not expected to die for 20, 30 years. And people who do legitimately buy policies in the secondary or tertiary market do not want to buy a payment stream of 30 to 40 years. And that's why the secondary market, even is the legitimate secondary market, even as it exists today, is primarily focused on older age policies. It's not anything nefarious at all. It's simply a matter of economics.
Can you just real plainly tell me what insurable interest there was here?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
There were two. So number one, there was the insurable interest of Frank Garrett in his own life. Mr. Garrett is the one who procured the policy.
How long?
Pardon, what do you mean?
Well, I guess what I'm trying to get at is he had the insurance. The insurance policy was paid for him for 2 years, right? Then it was up to him whether or not he wanted to assume the payments and continue with the life insurance policy.
So this is, yes, but this is another, I think, misunderstanding or misstatement of the record, not by any fault of this court, but I think in briefing and discussion. There's no magic to 2 years in this case. The loan term in this case was 7 years. If you look at the loan commitment letter and the maturity date in the loan agreement, the maturity date was a 2013 maturity date on a 2006 loan. The premiums that were advanced were $893,000. The first 2 years of premium that were due, as stated in the loan documents, was about $671,000. So there was a loan for about 2.5 years, but that loan, or for about 2.5 years worth of premium. But Mr. Garrett and the trust did not have to pay back that loan for 7 years. The loan agreement provided that unless he died, the loan would mature upon his death. Unless he died, he had 7 years to actually.
Well, but correct me if I'm wrong, though. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That was actually one of the questions. It wasn't clear to me how this was set up. So then, You know, in after the 2 years, though, he received the notification that here are your three options that you can proceed in. So how did that work?
I don't believe there is such a notice in this case. That, again, is a vestige of other cases that are plainly distinguishable that have two-year loan terms. But in this case, the evidence is that after about 2 years, Mr. Frank himself hired another agent, not Mr. Weissman, but a man by the name of Bill Nowak, to help him with options. And Mr. Nowak actually, independent of UNF, independent of Mr. Weissman, who originally sold him this life insurance policy, decided to help Mr. Garrett look for other options, including selling to anybody else, not surrendering the policy to UNF. And bear in mind, the interest rate on this policy was only prime plus 5%.
But from your perspective, though, what's the relevance of the 2 years then?
I find no relevance at all in the two. The one relevance I do find is that the premiums that were advanced by UNF in this case, $893,000, would only cover up until about the middle of, so the policy and effective date of February 2008.
So is it incorrect to say that the trust owned the policy for 2 years?
The trust owned the policy for at least over three years.
But pursuant to the contract. Didn't the lender take over the policy after 2 years, or had the right to take over the policy after 2 years?
That's not accurate.
Okay.
The loan never became due until 2013.
So I just want to be clear, though. Policy becomes effective. Premiums are paid up front from the loan. When does that policy expire without any more payments? What's the date of expiration?
It doesn't expire as long as Mr. Garrett pays premiums.
No, I know. But if no more, if he doesn't pay his own premiums after that loan is made, when does that expire?
Right. So I don't know exactly, but $893,000 was the amount of the loan. $671,000, I believe, is the amount for the first 2 years. So I'm estimating about 2.5 years. And there's a document.
So we don't really know for sure how long policy premiums were. There was sufficient funds under the loan to pay policy premiums.
Yes, UNF's loan was probably enough to pay premiums up until there's a document. It's actually record 4266. It is a history MassMutual produced of premium payments. And the loan was $893,000. What this premium payment shows is by July 30, 2008, $934,000 in premium had been paid. That's more than the UNF loan. There's no record, and this is by July 30, 2008. That's when Mr. Garrett still owned the policy. The Garrett Trust still owned the policy, had full control over the policy. The loan, the UNF loan amounts had already been exhausted. So somebody other than UNF, from July 30, 2008 on, paid premiums. It was not from the UNF loans. It could have been Garrett himself. Well, he could have gotten a loan. We don't know. The other thing that I think is very important about the UNF loan is he had the right to prepay it at any time. And there was no prepayment penalty. This case is just unlike any other case that you see. The trust had absolute control. This is not about doing indirectly, but they couldn't do directly. And I'd like to come back to the question of insurable interest.
Before you, again on the transaction. So a couple things. So after, but there did come a point where he relinquished, and it was, you know, somewhere around that, like 2.5 year.
It was another full year.
But in order to continue with the policy, he would have had to then come up with a way to pay them himself, whether it be by an additional loan through United or someone else. But as you pointed out, the funds ran out from the initial loan at that point. And it was never clear to me from the record how the premiums were paid. Whether they went directly from United to the insurance company. We did a go through the trust. I've never been able to quite parse that out.
I'm not sure. I would imagine that the loan funded the trust account and the trust paid the insurance company. But another very important factor in this case is this was fully transparent with the insurance company. So the state cites a lot of the same cases dealing with one loan, a loan by or associated with the Coventry company. And one of the things that was notable in that case and the Seventh Circuit case of what's called Corwell notes this is that the Coventry loan was structured such that the loan was made to a sub-trust and Coventry took a back-end collateral interest in the sub-trust so that it was never known to the carrier. And that was one of the issues that they considered to make it STOLE. Here, UNF made the loan to the trust, record and had the trust sign a collateral assignment on a Mass Mutual insurance company form and recorded that collateral assignment with the carrier. The carrier was aware of the loan at all times. And in 2009, over three years later, when Mr. Frank surrendered the policy, also different from these other cases, they submitted a change of ownership form from the trust to Newstream, which became the successor to UNF. So it was fully transparent that the trust had surrendered the policy to the lender in this particular case. And the timing here is really important because it wasn't 2 years, and I know that that term has been thrown about or that period of time, but it was 3.5 years. The policy became effective in February of 2006. The surrender occurred in August of 2009 and actually was effected in September of 2009. By that time, according to MassMutual's record at 4266, by that time, approximately $1.5 million of premiums had been paid.
You've got your red light on. I don't know if anybody else has questions.
No.
Or if you want to wrap up.
Yeah, I'll just wrap up by saying Frank Garrett had an insurable interest in his own life. Gene Garrett had an insurable interest in Mr. Garrett's life and was without question the beneficiary of all of the death benefits at the time the policy was issued, which is what matters, and for 3.5 years after that. There is no doing indirectly what one cannot do directly here. UNF made a loan, a legitimate transaction. Frank Garrett went out and got a life insurance policy, a legitimate transaction. Two rights do not make a wrong. This is not a case in which this loan was created for UNF to take it over from the start. The terms of this loan make that clear. There's just no evidence here at all that this was rigged to go to UNF. And the last thing I'd say is the records Mr. Kearns showed is when Mr. Kearns testified is when UNF saw that there were more defaults than they wanted, they didn't, unlike other cases, they didn't like take over these policies and because they wanted to take over. They sold the notes. They sold the loans before foreclosures because they were concerned that the rest of the notes might actually result in foreclosures. And that's the record. So I think the district court was correct to rule on the plain language of the statutes, but there is no occasion here to pierce anything. You have two legitimate transactions. Together, they do not make one illegitimate transaction, and this court should affirm the lower court's ruling.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Novi, you may proceed with rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I will be brief. My friend does not truly contest the crux of the legal issue before this court is whether we should look at the substance of the transaction. It seems as though Viva is now essentially agreeing that, of course, this court must look at the substance. And now, the facts are all laid out very well in the trial court, and we will rest on those facts and what we put before the trial court. But just to shore up a few things, I know there were a lot of questions about this loan, so I want to address some of them. The first is, this was not a loan at all. And I know one of the questions the justices asked was, look, is this a loan? How are premiums even paid? This was not a loan because in a normal loan situation, the lender is interested in repayment from the borrower, which would require the borrower to have assets sufficient to repay the loan. Here, the lender was United and the borrower was a trust that had zero assets. United didn't care because it didn't want to get repaid on the loan. It wanted the collateral. It wanted the policy. My friend likened this to a mortgage, a foreclosure. This is nothing like that. That is a normal loan where the lender is interested in getting repaid. Here, there was no such interest. United, right, lent the loan to the trust, and this goes to another critical point. The trust was not this trust operated, controlled by Garrett and the family. There is, in the record, a specific power of attorney that grants United complete control of that trust from day one, even before the policy was issued. So,
Mr. LeQuang says there's a period of, there were $1.2 million in benefits paid before the policy was surrendered, or before policy was surrendered back to the UNF, and that exceeds the amount of the loan. Accurate? Not accurate.
1.2 million was.
He said that there were more premiums paid than the amount of the loan before it was surrendered. Is that accurate?
So it is accurate, and I'll tell you what the delta is. The delta is United's fee and United's attorney's fee. So he stood up here and said, look, the loan is $900,000 and the premiums were only $700,000. The record reflects I just want to make sure I get this correct.
His specific representation was that money was paid as that the premium amount exceeded the amount. That's not accurate? The premium paid exceeded the amount of the loan.
That is, it exceeded the amount of the original loan, and then the lenders, the investors, had to keep paying premiums to keep the policy going until it could find another investor to buy the policy, which is what was happening.
And so you're saying that wasn't paid by the trust? Is there anything that showed that the trust or someone other than the lenders paid that additional amount?
The trust had no assets. It couldn't repay anything. So it was just additional loans from United and New Street.
That's not entirely accurate. The trust did have an asset. It had the life insurance, correct?
That's correct.
And so are you saying that UNF then was banking on the collateral actually being liquid, and the only way you can do that is wagering on Mr. Garrett's life?
That's correct.
Okay.
Are they wagering on his life, or are they wagering with him? Or does it matter? Or against him?
I think this goes to the consent issue. I don't think it matters. But at the end of the day, if there's some hesitancy that, look, Garrett consented to this transaction, and therefore everything's okay, everything's not okay, right? The analysis is under the insurable interest statute. Consent is not enough in this context.
Of course, he could gamble on his own life.
Now, that would be a different factual scenario.
Understood.
If Mr. Garrett decided to take out a policy, pay all the premiums, do everything that's necessary to effectuate the policy, just with the subjective intent of selling the policy later, that is completely different than what we have here. That's more like our friend's cases, Kramer, Pruko, and a few others, where the policy is actually controlled by either the person or a family member. This was in a trust controlled by investors from day one, and it actually is telling. My friends can't cite a single case where in this type of factual scenario, where the trust is controlled by the underlying investor from day one, where the court did not find it was this type of stolen transaction. And with that, I'll see the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this morning. The court case is fully submitted. We'll be in recess until for about 7 minutes.